website, or do you have any events we can go to or anything like that?
We have a Facebook site, and it is actually Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women USA. And we do a lot of informational, plus we look for people. But what the listeners can do actually is join us there so that they can help give these women a voice. Tell a few people, direct them to the site, and just, just help us get this out, that this is here and that people know that it exists, so that we will have more power to change this. 1,000 voices is better than one.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2016 Juneteenth Oregon Celebration, Saturday, June 18th. The Clara People's Freedom Trail Parade begins at 10:45 a.m. starting on Northeast 8th in Jarrett, continuing south on Martin Luther King Boulevard and west on Russell. It will end at the Juneteenth Oregon Celebration at Legacy Emanuel Field at Northeast Graham in Vancouver at noon. The celebration will be from noon to 7 p.m. and feature family fun and activities, community vendors, music and other live entertainment, and much, much more. Again, that's the 2016 Juneteenth Oregon Celebration, Saturday, June 18th, with the parade from 10:45 to noon and the celebration from noon to 7 p.m. at Legacy Emanuel Field at Northeast Graham in Vancouver and Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening. This is Fernando Gapacin on Second Monday Labor Radio. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7. My co-host is Elizabeth Ann McDonald. She's a member of Laborers 483, and I'm a member of the United Auto Workers 1981. Labor Radio is of, by, and for the working class. And tonight's guest used to be actually one of the co-hosts for Labor Radio. She's now the editor of Labor Notes. Her name is Alexandra Bradbury. And she used to be a resident of Portland, and she'd been a researcher and organizer for hospital workers with the Service Employees International Union, Local 49. And right now, Alexandra is living in New York. And Al, would you like to tell our audience how you got to New York?
Sure. Hi, and thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
Well, I moved to New York to work for Labor Notes. And for people who don't know, Labor Notes is a magazine and organizing project dedicated to putting the movement back in the labor movement. We're trying to build, we like to think of it as the troublemaking pole in the labor movement. So that means through our magazine and reporting and our conferences and trainings, supporting rank and file to rank and file connections, supporting people in developing organizing skills and pushing for more action on the job and pushing for more democratic and inclusive and participatory unions and for taking on bigger picture social issues as well, and for sort of building a more fighting labor movement.
Well, I've been a long time fan of Labor Notes. I think I got directly involved with them in the early 80s, mid 80s, especially around the P9 strike in Minnesota, Austin, Minnesota. And there the rank and file workers were fighting for a decent contract, and they had to fight both Hormel and their international union. And I remember Labor Notes playing a huge role nationally in terms of building support and educating workers then. Is that some of the work that you do now?
Yeah, definitely. And that's really, you know, some of the roots of Labor Notes. As you say, we're about bringing together rank and file, the democratic currents in different unions. When Labor Notes first got started, there was a real a movement among auto workers pushing for democracy, and within the Teamsters, within the mine workers union, and Labor Notes was first started as a sort of a newsletter. You know, this was of course before the internet. People had their landlines, and thought, well, let's put together a newsletter we can mail out so people who are fighting for a more fighting union in the mine workers know what people are doing in the Teamsters and vice versa. And in T9, as you say, some of those same kinds of currents. And so that's a role we've continued to play, to proudly play, I think, to be a space for people to find each other and support each other in pushing from within to make their unions better. I think, you know, a union like any other institution is what you make of it. It's what the members make of it. And there are plenty of unions in the United States that, you know, where unfortunately to fight the boss does involve also fighting with union tops. And so we want to help provide people the tools and resources to do that. The working class in this country, we've got a lot of fights to fight. So we think part of our work is helping people do that and take on whoever they need to fight for more justice and power in the workplace.
You know, it's I was really happy that you wanted to be on the show, and anytime I look at many of the current what I consider new wave stuff going on in the labor movement, I see Labor Notes people being part of it, and many of those folks came out of the traditions of the caucus movements. I know that a lot of the people that founded Labor Notes during the late 60s and 70s, there was a huge caucus movement within the United Auto Workers to democratize the United Auto Workers. And, you know, along with that, racial and gender caucuses emerged, asserting their rights. And I know that you and Mark and Brenner and Jane Slaughter, didn't you just publish a book on secrets of successful organizers?
We certainly did, yeah. And I'm really excited about this book. You know, one of the most exciting, one of the sort of bright lights in our movement recently, in the labor movement recently, certainly has been the Chicago Teachers Union. The organizing that they've done, the now two strikes that they've led citywide, and part of what's been exciting about that union is that they're taking on issues of racial justice and sort of, you know, taking on stronger issues, pointing to the system of educational apartheid in Chicago, building a movement with other organizations in the city. Part of what's been exciting about it is that they too are a reform union, a union where rank and filers got together and really changed the direction of their union. And also part of what's exciting about the Chicago Teachers is that they not only looked outside the union, not only looked at how do we build alliances and take on big issues, but they also really did the old-fashioned organizing from within, from the, you know, coworker to coworker, bottom up, like, how do you get organized at your school or at your job site? that is the building blocks of any successful organizing campaign. And I think, you know, there's a lot of buzz in the labor movement these days about sort of, do we need new models? Do we need new approaches? And I think it's good to have creativity and innovation, but we also shouldn't lose sight of that the building blocks of organizing are fundamentally what they always have been. They're one-on-one conversations. They're getting over the idea that your coworkers are apathetic and figuring out what are the issues that they care about and what are the things holding them back and what are some small actions you can take together, and how do you build power, how you build to larger actions, how you find the boss's weak points, you know, these sorts of things that are that for 100 years or more, or you know, hundreds of years, you might say, people have been figuring out how to build power in the worksite using basically the same tools. And so this book, Secrets of a Successful Organizer, that we've just put together, I am excited about because it is, I think, the most accessible book that we have ever put together as Labor Notes. You know, the Labor Notes book, A Troublemaker's Handbook, which is packed with stories from people fighting on the job, I think is very well beloved. But Secrets of a Successful Organizer, even more than that one, is really sort of hands-on and usable. And we tried to make it sort of a step-by-step guide to how do you begin mapping out your own workplace, recognizing who are the potential leaders that you want to get involved, recognizing what's a good organizing issue, and making a plan of action to tackle it.
You know, I've spent many years organizing workers, but also trying to study what it is that people talk about. And I guess fundamentally, what I try to pass on to folks is that rarely is the institution itself, the institutional union, the key to successful organizing. And it really gets down to the organizer that organizes people. I mean, people have to believe that person that's talking to them. Mm-hmm. And does your I read the outline that's in the Labor Notes website about the book, and it sounds like a very practical, usable book. How can people get a hold of it?
Online at our website, labornotes.org. If you go to labornotes.org, you can find it. Or if you want to go straight to the page where the book is, it's labornotes.org/secrets. And we've also made available on that website 42 handouts from the book, which are essentially, you know, pieces of the book. Some are charts and graphics and exercises that might be useful for a steward training or a meeting with your coworkers in a form that you can download and print out. So a bunch of the book actually you can find for free on the website, labornotes.org/secrets. And we have tried to make it, as you say, very practical and concrete. So there are things like step-by-step how you map out your workplace. There's a chart on the five big ways that bosses disorganize us and how to beat them. There's the action thermometer, which is a tool for mapping out different tactics and planning an escalating campaign of tactics. So in the book, we talk a little bit about how and why would you want to start with small tactics and get bigger, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, I started organizing with the hospital workers and my family organized farm workers, and it seems to me that the structure of work is different. I mean, when I started out organizing, you know, you've organized in the fields, you worked with people, or you worked in factories and you worked with people, and you could collective action seemed to be something that was doable. Nowadays, with the instability of work, temporary workers, workers going from job to job rapidly, does your book provide some ideas about how we can organize in those situations?
Yeah, Yeah, I agree with you that there are certainly ways that bosses have found to get more sophisticated in their ways of dividing us, and even in places where people have a common work site. I noticed in my organizing with hospital workers, for instance, that there was more and more sort of staggering of schedules, so everyone comes in and leaves at different times. I think yes, those are challenges, and yeah, we tried to suggest some in thinking about how do you map out your workplace, how do you find where are the opportunities and where are the obstacles. But it is also encouraging to see that even in our day, collective action does still work. And I think the just concluded strike by Verizon workers here on the East Coast, I don't know how closely people were following that on the West Coast, but was a pretty inspiring example of workers in a traditional job, who we're told have very little leverage these days with private sector unionism. It's 6.7%, I think, and declining. Still wielding power and still in the ways that they always have, right? That it turned out when Verizon landline workers walked off the job, the scabs and managers they sent didn't know how to do the work that they supervised people doing and couldn't really fill in for them. And that immensely profitable corporation gave in and settled the contract with the workers. And so I do think, some of the same tactics can work regardless of industry. We do, I think, have this idea in our collective consciousness that factory workers won what they won because of something unique about, manufacturing jobs are good jobs. Manufacturing jobs didn't used to be good jobs. People made them decent wage jobs by striking and organizing, and there's no structural reason why that couldn't be true of service economy jobs or new economy jobs. I mean, certainly there are, legal obstacles that employers have been throwing up in the form of misclassifying jobs as independent contractors and things like that, that we do have to fight. But to some extent, you find ways of talking to each other. You find where your leverage is, no matter what your job.
Al, I have to take a station break for just a second, and mm-hmm. I want to get back to you. I want to talk about the Driscoll boycott. That's sort of been sort of a buzz in the Portland area in the Northwest, and I'd like to talk to you some about that. But right now, I want to let people know that you're listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7, and this is Labor Radio, second Monday, Labor Radio. I also want to make a brief announcement about the LGBTQ Pride Parade. It's going to be June 19th at 11 a.m. Burnside and Northwest Park will be the gathering point. And there will be a labor contingent organized by Portland's Pride at Work, the LGBTQ constituency group of the AFL-CIO. Back to Al Bradbury. Al, can I ask you, can you tell my audience about the Driscoll boycott and what is driving it in terms of workers' rights?
Absolutely. So there's a group of farm workers in Washington State in the Bellingham area who are berry pickers. They are mostly immigrants from Oaxaca and Guerrero in Mexico, mostly indigenous workers who have immigrated to the U.S. and some of whom migrate between California and Bellingham by the seasons. But a number of people who've been working for a number of years picking berries in that region, who in the summer of 2013 or so came together and formed an independent union, Familias Unidas por la Justicia, Families United for Justice, and walked off the job on a number of strikes. I believe the first one was in defense of a coworker who'd been unfairly fired, but they have a list of demands that they've been pushing for and building for, including that they want $15 an hour. They want some safety against harassment from supervisors. They want improved living conditions. This is a kind of job where people live in a company-controlled camp. You know, a whole set of things. But they've had a number of job actions, a number of strikes. And because the farm, the Tacoma Brothers farm, where they work, has continued to resist recognizing the union or bargaining with the workers for a union contract, they called a boycott of the berries. And the you know, interesting instance of class solidarity, the farm where they work is Tacoma Brothers, but the berries get distributed through this company, Driscoll. And there's been even, I think, you know, different companies sort of mislabeling the berries in different ways as the boycott has built in efforts to sell them to the public, sign, I think, of the boycott success. But that's an ongoing boycott. And then last year, a bunch of farm workers in Baja California went on strike against Driscoll's also. There, I know one of the big issues was sexual harassment from supervisors in the fields and taking on that issue. But again, you know, with a set of issues, and in part because many farm workers have migrated across borders or have family, there were all of these connections already, and so they've been working together to some extent in supporting one another's boycott of Driscoll's. So there's a transnational boycott against Driscoll's in support of these multiple farm worker efforts and the ongoing organizing. And I know that the Driscoll's berries, we've started. I just saw some in the co-op grocery store here in Brooklyn, the nearest my home. So we're gonna have to send a message to Driscoll's that the boycott is following them to the East Coast as well, and we're not gonna let them sell those scab berries anywhere.
Well, you know, this harkens back to the great grape strike and boycott in 1965, and of which I was a part, and my family, you know, worked in, and I was wondering. Was there a reason they picked the independent route or developed their own independent union? Historically, I've found that when workers begin by organizing themselves, their unions or their efforts tend to stay together better. And there's been a couple times I've organized workers and then they picked the union they chose to be part of. Is there a reason they organize independently besides the obvious one, which is maybe unions didn't reach out to them?
You know, that might be the reason. You would have to ask them about sort of whether they've reached out to any unions or what the why they haven't, for instance, connected with an existing farm workers union. But I do know that it's been a very grassroots, workers did self-organize, that got together and began their strike. And I know that, and I should say that they've certainly, got support from other unions in Washington state. We had a troublemaker school, which is a 1-day conference that Labor Notes helps people organize last year in Seattle. And the president of the Farm Workers Union, a familiar to me, spoke at that, and to the great delight of an assembly of other union activists from the Boeing engineers to grocery workers to hospital workers, and I know that there's a contingent of grocery workers who've been active in building that boycott, which of course takes place at grocery stores. So certainly they've connected with the labor movement in Washington state. But you might be able to speak better than I to what the landscape is for farm worker you know, existing farm worker organizing in Washington State, why they might choose to go an independent route. I think what I know is that they didn't wait for somebody to come organize them. They built their own organizing effort.
Well, I know there's the Immokalee workers in Florida provide a great example of how an independent union can build a successful boycott and win over the large corporations by depending mostly on grassroots support from grassroots activists rather than institutional unions. But I'm not pitting one against the other. I mean, the resources of the union movement were quite effective. I think of how the longshore workers made the United Farm Workers struggle incredibly effective in the boycott of grapes. I was just wondering, because I'm looking always at all of the alternatives in terms of organizing workers, not just traditional unions.
Yes, certainly. And I mean, there are many interesting aspects of that struggle. You know, the employer has tried to bring in guest workers to replace them, which then was the subject of some legal challenge, because you're not legally supposed to use guest workers as a bludgeon against worker organizing. Farm workers, of course, are in an interesting position, excluded from the law that gives most, the federal law that gives most workers in the U.S. The protected right to organize. Doesn't mean they can organize, but the National Labor Relations Board doesn't protect organizing rights for farm workers and domestic workers in the same way as for most other private sector workers, which, of course, was a deliberate exclusion, a deliberate racist exclusion by Congress at the time that law was passed. They are also an interesting group of workers in that, although they're mostly from Mexico, they're not mostly Spanish speakers. They're mostly speakers of indigenous languages from the parts of Mexico that they're from. And I think you show tremendous initiative in organizing in a country where they're in a whole set of marginalized positions, but finding the leverage that, I mean, I think it's a tremendous testament to the fact that workers still have power by virtue of doing work, and food is still something that we all rely on, and the workers who produce food by organizing can bring corporations to heel. So it's a very inspiring and very interesting story.
Well, you know, our Second Monday Labor Radio has tried to focus on building communities of solidarity, and basically what that means is the notion that for long-term successful organizing, large sections of a community have to own the workers' struggle as their own. Mm-hmm. And so we've made it a habit of trying to have organizers talk about their experiences and promote the idea of people learning from each other. And so I'd really like to invite you to come back on again.
Thank you. I'd love that.
And the thing is that is there a local point person here in Portland for Labor Notes? I know that we have a troublemakers group, and we meet periodically to organize events. But is there a specific contact person for Labor Notes here in this area?
Not really. The troublemakers group that you're referring to is the way that people have built an ongoing sort of sort of network, and have organized a couple of troublemaker schools in Portland, and I imagine will again in the future. I know your labor radio colleague,
Jamie Partridge.
Yes, certainly has been involved in that, and Johanna Brenner and Megan mm-hmm. Heiss, you know, a number of people with labor radio ties have been a part of that organizing. But probably the simplest way for people to connect in either is to find that Northwest Troublemakers group on Facebook, or to give me a call or email at the Labor Notes office in New York, and I can always help connect people up.
Okay, and again, what's the Labor Notes website?
LaborNotes.org, LaborNotes.org.
I appreciated having you on, Alejandra.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Talk to you soon.
You too. All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7. This is Labor Radio, Second Monday Labor Radio, hosted by Elizabeth Ann McDonald and Fernando Gapacin. See you in a month.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Debtors' Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st at 4 p.m. under the bridge.